Actually, it was only a few years ago I began to follow Ronald Reagan's example, a little nap after lunch, siesta time in Florida. So, and this is not my prime time of day, that's for sure. But Grand Canyon is one of my favorite places and one of the most exciting places you can visit when it comes to looking firsthand at some of these questions related to origin. So I hope that'll keep me awake and maybe in the process, you know, keep you awake as well. Then we'll be looking forward to a time of questions afterward. It looks like we've got some really good questions too. Well, as I mentioned in the session before lunch, you know, I began my teaching career, you know, as an evolutionist and really excited about evolution and so on. And I thought, boy, you know, if any Christian would just make a trip to Grand Canyon, just look over the edge of the canyon, a mile deep. You can see these rock layers stacked up a mile deep, stretching underground for thousands of square miles, and the simple things on the bottom are getting more complex as you go up. You can see the stages of evolution right before your very eyes. You can see how much time would have to go by to stack up all those rock layers. If a Christian would ever just go to Grand Canyon, he'd just throw his Bible over the edge. Well, that was before I'd been there, okay? And so after I got there, after I became a Christian and began to get these things straightened out, since then, I've led about 40 week-long hikes through Grand Canyon and two raft trips. And as a matter of fact, I may as well just ask for a prayer request. And two summers ago or three, sometime recently, you know, I was still doing that. And the last day on the rim trip, you know, I give them a rim to the river, hike and back in one day. You know, don't do that unless you're planned and prepared for it. And that's really nice. But boy, something happened to my health between that summer and the next December. Irregular heartbeat and exhaustion, all this. And so the last time I took students there, I took them down to 3 Mile. That's the introduction, you know, simple hike. And then they wondered why I was carrying such a big pack, because I told them, you guys going back, don't worry about me until it gets well after dark. You know, and I gave them a time. And so a hike that would normally take me a couple hours, you know, took 6. Actually, I did it in 5.5. I surprised myself. But so actually, praise God, I seem to be getting better. I just hate the thought of not being able to do those Grand Canyon hikes. It's a fabulous excursion. My wife and I, with ICR's help, are going to be starting work on a Christian guide, Christian family guide to the national parks and the wonders of God's creation. Grand Canyon, Yosemite, Olympic Peninsula, things like that. And, you know, it's kind of, you hate to go to all these parks, you know, and you get this evolutionary story, which, by the way, the park rangers usually don't believe or don't know anything about. If you ask them a question, oh, I don't know, they just told me to say that, you know, and so on. But now I'm ready to stake out the place with Bible verses. You can really see right there at Grand Canyon, what you see at Grand Canyon really agrees with what we read in God's Word about His perfect creation, corrupted by man's sin, destroyed by the catastrophe of Noah's flood, to be restored to new life in Jesus Christ. Well, here's some of the creatures whose fossils, I want to get a little better picture of this, but here's some creatures whose fossils we find there at Grand Canyon. And remember, according to evolution, you know, you have few simple beginnings, life thrown together by time and chance, and struggling with each other, killing off the competition, making ever more fit forms, and so on. And so if evolution were true, where would you find fossils of animals like these? Well, if evolution were true, you'd find fossils of animals like these way up near the top, after millions, if not billions of years, you know, of evolution. But since evolution is not true, you find fossils of animals like these at the bottom, not only in Grand Canyon, but right around the world. By evolutionist's own definition, the first or simplest community of living things to leave an abundance of fossil remains is called the Cambrian system. And worldwide, even evolutionists, this is a term that they've coined, refer to the Cambrian explosion. Life just explodes onto the scene in incredible diversity and complexity. So you can imagine one of those thought experiments like the gravity tube. Only now you're in an earth boring tube. So you're down under the earth, clawing your way toward the surface, and no fossils, no fossils, no fossils. A few things, and wow, everything. In fact, Stephen Gould, when he was an archenemy of creation, said there are way more body plans, way more different kinds of features in those first forms of life preserved as fossils than there are today. And so instead of upward, onward progress, it looks like the opposite. All the different sea creatures are found right there from the very beginning. It's not a sequence from simple to complex, but from sea bottom creatures to near shore to lowland to upland. Complex animals and plants from the beginning all the way through. And so even they refer to this as the Cambrian explosion. And when I became a Christian, as I told you, while I was teaching at a Christian college as an evolutionist. Well, after that great debate, I had a chance to go back to work on a doctoral degree and add a minor in paleontology, the study of fossils. Now I knew I was a Christian. Pretty sure I was a creationist. I knew I was in biology, but what about the fossils? And even though my professors all believed in evolution, what they taught me about fossils made it hard to believe in evolution, easy to believe the biblical theme, creation, corruption, catastrophe, Christ. And so my evolution prof, who was actually a good friend, I went on every field trip he ever had. You know, I was a real enthusiastic student. But he said, never let anybody tell you a trilobite is a simple animal. And these are the ones that evolutionists use to define the lowest Cambrian, the first appearance of abundant fossils. And this is just one. There are lots and lots and lots of varieties and kinds of these trilobites. And they're kind of like a horseshoe crab. I'm sure many of you are familiar with those. And wow, you know, they have all kinds of little legs, you know, underneath, and they have antennae, and they have these fantastic eyes. Here's a close-up. Some of these are preserved so well. Of course, the lens is a mineral anyway. They're preserved so well, scientists can shine light through them and see how they focus light. Some of them had a fiber optic system. And every time man invents something, oh, shucks, God beat me to it. God already had it. Some of them have double corner bounces, you know, off mirrors. Just fantastic. Completely formed, you know, complex right from the beginning. You know, no stages between this kind of eye and any other kind of eye right there at the bottom. And so to use that verse from Romans 1, the creation is clearly seen. I guess there's a pun in there somewhere, you know, in the eyes of these trilobites. Well, for years, until just recently when my wife and I started this creation museum, I taught at Clearwater Christian College in the Tampa Bay area. And you're not going to believe this. What you have to do to be a college teacher every spring, year after year after year after year, I had to take students on a scuba diving trip to the Florida Keys. Oh, it was a dirty, rotten job, you know. Somebody had to do it. You know, and the water is so hot, you don't even want to wear a wetsuit. Oh, it's just miserable. But at any rate, I get students on these scuba trips, and I tell them, when you're underwater with a face mask on, many of you have had this experience, things look bigger and closer than they really are. So when you see shark, it's only shark, so don't worry about it. The trilobite didn't have that problem. It saw things undistorted, true distances and so on. Handcrafted prescription lenses from the master designer. And in fact, if you were able to go scuba diving when there were lots of trilobites in the ocean, compare that with life in the ocean now, what would you say? Wow, look at all the upward, onward progress in the last 600 million years. No, exactly the opposite. You'd say, what happened? Where did everything go? There used to be, you know, scores of different kinds of trilobites. There used to be these great big nautiloids, the shelled squid, like the little chambered nautilus we have today. There are fossils, ones with shells bigger than tractor tires. Polished up, they're so beautiful, one sold at the Tucson Rock Show for $120,000. Where'd they go? All those lamp shells, there's a handful left today. There used to be scores of different kinds. Instead of a record of upward, onward progress, you look at the fossils, and it's a record of death, decline, disaster, decline in size, decline in variety. Wow, it just looks like a wreck. Something happened to destroy God's perfect creation. And the opposite of evolution. Darwin knew about that. And I got off the plane in Chicago one time for some creation evolution meeting, and interviewer put a microphone on my face, you know, what do you think about Darwin? And I said, oh, I said, I think Darwin was, or what do you think about fossils? And I said, oh, I think Darwin was right about the fossils. And she looked at me, well, oh, I'm sorry, she said, I thought you were the creationist. I said, I am the creationist. Now I got her puzzled. I love to do that. Now she's got to ask, well, now you're the creationist, but you think Darwin was right about fossils. She's got to ask me, what do you mean by that? And of course, what I mean is that Darwin called fossils the most obvious and serious objection to evolutionary theory. You know, in fact, in that debate, by the way, with the Bible department and so on, someone asked one of the Bible profs, you know, about, you know, well, what evidence do you have? What makes you believe evolution? And he said, well, the fossils. And I said, well, what fossils? Name one. I'll talk about it. Well, fossils. The fact that there were fossils proved, no, you know, it's the opposite of evolution. And so in the preface to his, you know, that chapter, he talked about the sudden appearance of complex forms of life in the lowest known fossil-bearing strata, the Cambrian explosion. Intermediate lengths, Darwin said, geology most assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this is perhaps the most obvious and serious objection to the theory that he was proposing right from the word go. Fossils were a tremendous objection to evolution, a tremendous objection to upward onward progress, a tremendous demonstration of the awesome ability of death and struggle to make matters worse, not better. Well, what do modern evolutionists say? If Cambrian life is already so complex that it doesn't count as evidence for evolution, the modern evolutionist says, dig deeper, okay? The simple beginnings of life have to be further down in the rock record. Well, we've done that. And so my wife and I have been to Australia, and Australia is home to the world's oldest animal fossils. And I've got a picture here of the world's oldest animal fossil. Okay, now, don't make any mistakes. It's not this. This is my wife over here. Oh, by the way, I don't want to make the rest of you ladies jealous. But do you realize that my wife is the luckiest woman on earth? See, she's married to a paleontologist. The older she gets, the better she looks to me. Wow, what a system. And since she's 3,000 miles away, I guess I can say that. But then the picture there in that circle is one of these Ediacara jellyfish. And this is in the there's a lot of outback in Australia. This is way out there. You got to drive 30 miles one way to get permission to drive 30 miles the other way out in this trackless desert in the heat of February, which is like our August, in an Australian outback desert. It gets to 120 degrees. We go shopping. She wants me to drive the car up on the sidewalk in front of the air-conditioned door. But boy, if it's fossils there, wow, she's on the way, you know, right then. Here's a close-up of that particular jellyfish, and you see the circumferential and the radial canals there. There's segmented worms there, too, night crawlers, earthworms. By the way, living in Australia today, they've got 10-foot earthworms. And, of course, Australians are desperate, you know, for tourists. They've actually got an earthworm museum. Who would go to an earthworm museum? Okay, my wife and I did. And you could actually hear them underground. Like that. Of course, they use earthworms as bait for great white sharks, okay? But an earthworm is not, you know, a simple organism at all. My daughter does science ed classes, you know, for her homeschool group there. And they were just looking at the insides of earthworms. They have a two-hemisphere brain, mouth, pharynx, esophagus, crop, gizzard, intestine, a pair of nephridia or kidneys in every segment, 5 hearts. Arteries, capillaries, veins, the works, very complex. So even when you look at these soft-bodied remains, you find the same thing, well-designed to multiply after kind. But I think those things are telling us more than just about creation, you know, and corruption and death. They might also be telling us something about how fast those rocks were deposited. You know, how long would it take to fossilize a jellyfish? Well, many of you have been out to the shore, you know, and you see jellyfish wash up on shore and so on, and in just a few hours, you know, they just turn to a blob of jelly. They don't look like anything. Now, danger, the stinging cells still work. Yeah, I remember one time when I was a kid growing up in Florida, and folks went to, you know, a motel by the beach, you know, and I'm out splashing around the way, and then I see a whole bunch of Portuguese men of war blown ashore, and I thought, wow! You know, so I grabbed the paper cup, ran out, scooped up a bunch of them, ran back to the motel room, poured them in the pitcher, went back to get more. My dad came in. Grabbed the pitcher of water, till it up, scurrying them all across the river. I'm glad I couldn't hear what he said to me, but I could feel what he said. So the stinging cells still work, but they just a blob. They don't look like anything. And so the evolutionists who found these said, you know, if you're going to fossilize a jellyfish, it's going to have to land on a wet sand that acts like a natural cement. You know, that's the way rocks form. It doesn't take millions of years of heat and pressure. Sedimentary rocks form the same way concrete cures. And so if you get the right mix of water and sediment, then it's usually lime or silica that are two major cements. And that, you know, starts off a little squishy. And then as the water, by the way, doesn't dry out, the water gets absorbed into the crystal structure and it hardens. Well, if you try to put a handprint, you know, it's too wet, no handprint. Too dry, no handprint. There's just that critical time when it's just right. You know, you can leave an impression or a little heart, you know, something like that. And so he's saying these jellyfish must have landed on a wet sand, acting as a natural cement, took that impression and preserved it quickly before the animal rotted away. But he didn't mean one jellyfish in 24 hours. He meant the entire Ediacara fossil formation, 300 miles from South Australia into the Northern Territories, all that in less than 24 hours. Is there anything at all in the Bible that would help us understand how you could bury 300 miles worth of jellyfish in less than 24 hours in the middle of what's now the driest continent on Earth? Could it be? Could this have something to do with Noah's flood? And it really could. And notice, you'd have to have the same conditions for that same sand, same amount of cement over hundreds of miles. Like Dr. Morris showed you that slide of that special sandstone. Over most of North America, same conditions over broad areas. It really looks like a worldwide global watery catastrophe. And of course, in that catastrophe, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, the Bible can't be true, because if, you know, Noah's flood was true, everything would be all mixed up. And a debate in Australia one time, you know, a fellow said that. He said, you know, look, obviously the Noah's flood can't explain the fossils, because then you'd have mice, you know, in the same layers as trilobites. Explain that. And so when I got up, you know, for my rebuttal, I said, well, you know, mice live on land, trilobites live in the deep ocean, maybe that explains why you don't find them together. He said, oh, he said, I was just joking about that. No, you'd have separate environments today. Do you realize there in the sea cliffs and sunset cliffs in San Diego, you've got all these clams, snails, limpets, abalones, nudibranchs, all kinds of things living there, and a few little fish. But if a cliff caves in, you'd get all kinds of shell deposits. But you wouldn't even know that there were pine trees existing at the same time, that there were big fish existing at the same time. It's really different environments. And the Bible tells us it was a year. Noah was in the ark over a year, and it was 5 months, 150 days, before finally all the high hills under the whole heavens were covered with water. So in the first stages, the continents would be eroding and so on. And by the way, those figures Dr. Morris used, you know, the erosion rates for the continents do take into account. Plate tectonics do take into account volcanoes and all that kind of stuff. Still, it would erode flat in 14 million years. So here you have the continents eroding, filling up the ocean basins. As that piles up, then the near shore forms get buried on top of them, then the lowland upland plants, and finally man and those that lived in that environment in the pre-flood world. And so it really looks like stages in the burial of different environmental zones during the year of Noah's flood, not stages in evolution over millions of years. But some people say, well, yeah, you know, I can see what you're saying, but, you know, really it takes millions of years to form fossils. You know, that can't really be true. I was on a call-in show in Miami one time, and a fellow called in. He said, the Earth has to be millions of years old. I've been to the petrified forest in Arizona. Well, I've been there, too. It's really the petrified log jam. But he's saying, I've been to the petrified forest. There are big logs, bigger than I can reach both my hands in diameter. That's not length. That's how wide they are. And they really are. They're awesome-sized logs that stretch from here out the door, you know, over 100 feet long. And he said, and there are zillions of them all over the place. He said it must have taken millions of years to turn those great big trees into solid rock. And so I said, well, let's think about that for a minute. You know, if a tree fell over in a forest or a lake or a river and just laid there for millions of years, you know, wouldn't the termites eat it up? You know, wouldn't the fungus and the bacteria decompose it? And even sunlight and water, you know, break down wood, and it just rot away. It wouldn't turn into a fossil. But
Let's imagine it got swept up in a slurry of limey mud or volcanic ash. It got buried so the termites and the bugs couldn't get at it. And in that limey mud or silica-rich sand or that volcanic ash, minerals, you know, would crystallize in a pore space, just like kids do with a crystal kit. You know, I just put mixed crystals in the thing, put a little string in there, and the crystals form right around the string. You know, right away, not millions of years later. Crystals form rapidly under the what? Right conditions. It's not time, it's conditions. If the conditions are wrong, billions of years won't help. If the conditions are right, you don't need the time. And so then they'd be preserved. Once they fossilized, once you got the minerals crystallized in, then the termites couldn't eat them. They'd be preserved so we could see them today. You know what he said? Huh, I believe you're right about that. First instant convert I ever made. There's actually a formula you can use to make petrified wood commercially. And you can put in your order on Monday. It'll be shipped out on Friday. Not Friday a million years, but Friday that week. No problem at all. We have now in our museum something my wife and I watched form in Mother Shipton's cave in central England. So as we were going over there on the creation tour one time, here's this little stream flowing through layers of limestone. And so the water was really had a lot of lime in it, and it was just spilling over a little ledge, you know, maybe 12 or 15 foot drop, little trickly waterfall. And somewhere along the line, somebody said, well, see what happens. And they just put a little string there and hung a teddy bear, you know, this lime-rich water. And about 3 months later, this soft, cuddly teddy bear, you know, became a hard, rocky teddy bear. And that's the way fossils form. They just accumulate mineral, you know, in the pore spaces like that. Doesn't take millions of years at all. In the Czech Republic, they actually make paper roses. I'm not sure why they don't use real roses, but they take paper roses, and they've got a hot mineral springs there. You just dip them in the hot mineral springs, and in about a week, you know, then you've got a petrified paper rose. I should have a photograph of that, but I haven't got it in here yet. And, of course, Dr. Moore showed you petrified fence posts, the limestone cowboy, where we know by direct observation that fossils can form very rapidly. In fact, they can't form slowly. If you leave something just lying out, you know, for millions of years, it doesn't fossilize. It rots away and decomposes. Fossils have to form rapidly, or they don't form at all. Well, here's one of my favorites. And so my wife and I are hunting fossils in shell pits in Florida. And you can find, you know, giant mammoths and mastodons, giant whales, llamas, camels, giant ground sloth, all kinds of things in there. And, of course, you can find lots and lots of shells. And so we were hunting, you know, kind of like the shell collecting. And all of a sudden, I hear from the other side of the quarry, Gary, come see what I found, come see what I found. So I run over, he's obviously very excited, and there it is in her hand. And, you know, I can tell right off. I mean, I'm a scientist. I can see that's a clam, okay? So, you know, I look at that, and I kind of look at my wife. You know, I was a long run in the hot sun. Say, well, yeah, that's a beautiful clam you've got there. Oh, no, look closer. So I look closer. Oh, yeah, it's an exquisitely, elegantly beautiful polycepod. Oh, no. You're missing the point. Look there. And then I look there, and all of a sudden I did notice there's some meat, some flesh, some organic material on this shell. She said, look at that. And I said, oh, yeah, it's got meat on it. You've got an exquisitely, beautiful, ornately sculptured, stinky polycepod. No, you're missing the point. And she had recognized that that was a Pliocene index clam. Now, Dr. Morris talked about that. You know, how do you know how old a rock is? Well, by the fossils it contains. And well, I'm not going to say that. And so here she knew this was an index. See, for evolutionists, it's an index to time. And so this clam was supposed to live at least 2 million years ago, maybe 5 million years ago, somewhere in that time range. For a creationist, index fossils don't tell you when a clam lived. They tell you where a clam lived in the pre-flood world. And so index specimens for creationists are fossils that lived in a certain environment in the pre-flood world. But thinking for a minute like an evolutionist would have to say that, now that I haven't got the real clam, by the way, that's just a space holder until I get the real one up there. But a clam that lived, a Pliocene index, would be at least 2 million years old, maybe 5 million. And so we decided to take it up to the State Museum. Mary has a great working relationship with the State Museum there in Florida. In fact, she's shuttled shells from Tampa over to New Zealand and back for people. And we just donated some more specimens to them. And we've donated several specimens to the State Museum that, you know, nobody else has found, or only a few have been found and so on. So she's gone up there. But I thought that she'd misidentified the clam. Now, I've confessed and gotten forgiveness for this. But I thought she'd misidentified the clam that was just a modern clam that crawled into the shell pit and died a couple of weeks before. But I had a plan in mind. Being a loving, supportive husband, I did drive her 2.5 hours up to the State Museum. We go into the back room, and I just turn behind the door. And so as soon as the scientist there tells her that she's misidentified the clam, I was going to put my arms around her and give her those three words every woman wants to hear. Let's eat out. Okay? I was going to take her to Sonny's Real Pit Barbecue. So, first of all, she takes the thing over there, and the guy looks at it and says, "You're right. That's a Pliocene Index clam." Gives a Latin name for it. I got to memorize that name sooner or later. And says, "You're right. It's still got some of the meat on it." "And you're right," she says, "these things are a real mystery. You know, how could meat not rot for 2 million years, you know, in the hot Florida shell pit?" And he said, "You know, these things are a real mystery," and then pulled out a drawer full of them. Wasn't the first one he'd seen. He'd seen plenty of them. But notice they were in a drawer in the back room. They were not on public display. Ours is on public display. And by the way, she went back there another time. We go there fairly frequently. And she happened to notice on the desk, and he caught her eye looking over at a chunk of fossil coral on his desk. And sure enough, what was in it? A spark plug. Okay. And he says, yeah. He says, that's really kind of neat, you know, spark plug and fossil coral. I know what you creationists are going to say about that. There's all this evidence around there that the millions of years are just a myth. And so, fossils that cut through many rock layers, the ones that Dr. Morris talked about, the polystrates, found abundantly in coal deposits. And most of you have heard it still, you know, taught in schools and so, that coal formed in swamps over millions of years. Do you know that there never was, one of the most interesting things in the history of evolution is, where did they ever come up with these ideas? There never was any evidence that coal and swamps go together. Nothing about coal deposits has anything in common with swamp deposits. Nothing. You may say, well, don't be that hard. They're both made out of plant material. Well, that doesn't count, because the kind of plants you find in coal are not the kind of plants you find in swamps. We were touring a coal mine in Victoria, in the southern part of Australia. And, you know, guide was going through how these things used to live in swamps and, you know, kind of point out, well, wait a minute. A lot of the material here is this kingbilly pine that only grows on steep slopes where the roots have to be out of the water or they get root rot and die. And his eyes got kind of wide. He said, oh. He said, I guess they must have grown differently in the past. I guess so. Doesn't make any sense. And so when Dr. Austin, before he was Dr. Austin, a student at Penn State, you know, major coal university, immediately, you know, the research people don't accept this swamp idea, but they want to know, well, if it's not swamps, what is it? And so Dr. Austin came up with this idea, floating mats. And so mats of vegetation, you know, ripped up in violent storms, such as that tsunami. Oh, my stars, you know. There were all these historical examples, but that really was something. All these things before happened 100 years ago or so. It just shears off. You get waves of water, you know, coming in with great force, you know, through a forest area, and, you know, an example much closer to home. You know, it breaks the tree trunks right off at ground level, separates the stems from the roots, breaks off the branches, strips off the bark, breaks off the leaves, breaks off the cones, pollen, stuff like that, floats them out over the ocean as they settle down to the bottom, mixing in with the ocean sediments. There'll be a layer, you know, spores and pollen will settle out at this layer. In coal, that shows up as a yellow stain layer called sporonite. Bark sheets will settle out in another layer, pink stain layer called vitrinite. And then the tree trunks will settle at various angles, you know, depending, separated from their roots and so on. And, of course, a lot of you know that kind of firsthand. You know, May 18, 1980, ICR is sponsoring a 25th anniversary look at Mount St. Helens, May 20 and 21, just a little bit after the exact 25th year, in Longview here in Washington this month. So do we have flyers on that, Bruce? About that? Oh, okay. But anyway, see if you can find out a little bit more about that online or so. That would be a great conference. Well, you know, that first eruption, first modern eruption of Mount St. Helens blows 1,300 feet off the northwest face and so on. Mud flowed down into Spirit Lake, sloshes a wave of water 864 feet up the side of Mount St. Helens, sheared off a million trees in a matter of moments. Talk about clear cutting. Okay. Wow! That really took them out of there. It flowed out over Spirit Lake. Bark sheets settled in one layer. Spores and pollen settled in another layer. Cones and leaves settled in different layers and so. And as the logs waterlog, you know, they'll float vertically like this. One end gets heavier, sink themselves down into the layers at several different layers from horizontal to vertical at various things like that. And so what we see at the bottom of Spirit Lake looks like the early stages. The coal isn't forming there yet, but it's set up for that. And so if you had more layers dumped on top of that squeezed out the excess water and let the wood char without oxygen, you could get coal, which in the lab only takes minutes to form under the right conditions. And so here you see all that formed rapidly under catastrophic conditions. Well, I was sharing this one time at the University of Glasgow in Scotland. And that's a major university, famous for coal exploration. That's where the Carboniferous period was named. And so I was, you know, telling about Steve Austin's work, and at the end of my talk, big burly student starts stalking toward the front. I didn't know Neanderthals were still alive, but here he came. You know? And so stalking toward the front, I'm kind of glancing toward exit rows. And he gets right in front of me, puts his hands on the desk, and looks right at me. I'm a student in coal geology at the university here. And I just want you to know what you said about coal is exactly right. And he went on to say, you know, he'd studied a lot of coal deposits, but he'd never seen the trunk attached to the roots. He'd never seen the branches attached to the stem. He'd never seen the leaves attached to the twigs and all that. In fact, scientists originally gave different genus species names to the leaves, cones, pollen, stems, and roots of the same tree. And it took them years to figure out these were the shredded remains of just one kind of plant. Something much more awesome than millions of years was going on here. A lot of water, not a lot of time. And of course, many of you know, I hope you've had reason to use it over the years, the Mount St. Helens video is a superb video to use with non-Christian friends. It's just, you know, the one thing I have to admit, evolutionists do have us beat in one area. Hands down. No doubt about it, the evolutionists win when it comes to visual aids. You know, they've got, billions of dollars of funding for all these nature programs and fantastic displays. And Carl Sagan's Cosmos, he couldn't find any fossils to make evolution work. But computer graphics, you could see it right before your very eyes, you know. And so we need to get some better vision. Here's one that can help you understand, see firsthand. Some of you almost saw it firsthand. You know, how rapidly things can happen, not slowly and gradually. So that's a great one. What about this one? This was one of the questions. One reason we moved the talk like we did is because a lot of the questions did come up, you know, the things we'll be talking about right now. Where's oil fit in this? You know, in the lab, it can take a few minutes, a few hours, a few weeks, you know, to form coal under the right conditions. How long does it take to form oil? Now, this may really surprise you. Zero. It doesn't take any time to form oil because it already was oil. Oil starts off as oil. And so the trick in getting oil deposits underground is not where did the oil come from. The trick to getting oil deposits underground is how did all those living things with these oil deposits get crushed and buried together? And so if plant, you know, oil is a storage form of energy in microbes and plants, animals, people. Fats are just slightly hydrogenated, solidified oils. And you squeeze on them, and they just, you know, it's just oil. Oil started off as oil. Corn oil, safflower oil, cod liver oil, and so on. And so the trick, if these animals and plants just die on the surface of the ground or in shallow graves, they get eaten up. And so to get oil underground, you need to trap zillions of microbes, plants, animals, and, sorry to say this, great-great-great-grandma and grandpa, need to get these remains of living things pressed underground. And if you get a whole bunch of them, you know, buried underground, the weight of the sediment squeezes the oil out of the bodies of these living things. Petroleum geologists think about a third of the world's oil came from a little microbe called Botryococcus. In Greek, that means oil ball, just like dinosaur in Greek means terrible lizard. And so it was already oil. So the trick is to get it buried underground. But of course, when the weight of sediment comes down on this oil, the oil is squeezed out into the water-laid sedimentary rock. What does oil do when it gets in water? It tends to float up to the top, you know, just like vinegar and oil salad dressing. And so, you know, the oil begins to move up to the top and so on, and it'll move through the pores and sandstone and lime and things like that. But if it hits a shale layer, the shale doesn't let it through very fast, the clay kind of stuff. And if that's shaped like a dome, then the oil pools under that shale. Poke a hole in it, what happens? Whoosh, up comes this gusher, black gold, Texas tea, okay? And it's interesting that scientists have calculated that all the oil reserves in the world, everything we know about, would have leaked to the surface in less than 200,000 years. But there's a lot of it left. A lot of it's in the wrong place politically, but there's a lot of it left. And that means the Earth has to be far, far, far younger than 200,000 years, or there wouldn't be any oil underground at all. And you can't form oil slowly. It's got to be trapped catastrophically, or you don't get any oil deposits. What do evolutionists say about this? Nothing. They don't talk about that at all. They don't even talk about that. They used to say, of course, they do say this, oh, if creation's taught in our schools, you know, science education will plummet, you know, and the Japanese will take over the world and and superstition will reign again. You know, what would happen if we had creationists, you know, scientists? What would happen if we had people like Isaac Newton, Louis Pasteur? That'd be great, wouldn't it? You know, science actually grew up under the tutelage of the Christian faith and so on. Christian heritage graduates, way back when the oil industry was really revved up in high speed, got jobs right away from our university at salaries twice what our salaries were. And, of course, they wanted to know, can you find oil? They don't care whether you believe in a young earth or an old earth. That has nothing to do with finding oil. And so, in fact, young earth would be a little bit of a help. You might look some places an evolutionist might not think of. But what about those layers? Okay, so here we have layers, all these layers, like Grand Canyon. Well, we do, you know, programs for young people and vacations for families and things like that where we are. And when we were at Clearwater Christian, we did it for schools and so on, still do. And we're always grateful when we get a public school group that would come. In fact, right now, by the way, the superintendent of instruction for DeSoto County wants all the middle schoolers to come through our museum. So that's a terrific opportunity. And so we had a public school class there. My wife was talking about things, and she asked the young people there, says, how long does it take for rocks to form layers? Hands went up all over the room, millions of years, millions of years, millions of years. Well, my wife says, you know, well, in science, we like to check our ideas against what we can see and measure. Says, I've got a tube here, and she's got a great big 4-foot plastic tube, and she got some stuff in it. We'll call it gravel, sand, and clay. She says, let's see what happens when I turn this over. So she turns it over, and all the stuff comes tumbling down through there. About 20 seconds later, there's a layer of gravel, a layer of sand, and a layer of clay beginning to form on the top. She says, can you see three layers? You know, students all nod. Well, how long did it take to make these three layers? Hands went up all over the room. Millions of years, millions of years, millions of years. See, and you thought public schools didn't teach anything. Oh, boy, do they. It's a knee-jerk reaction. And there's another thing, by the way, evolutionists got to speed on. They are good at teaching. Not what they teach, but how they teach. They really ingrain it. They indoctrinate. Boy, oh, boy, are they good at that. And so, of course, my wife is a patient woman. It's my job to train her in patience. So she says, you know, let me do this experiment over again. She says, now, you watch this the second on the little clock, and when it gets to 12, I'm going to shake this up, turn it over. And when I see three layers, I'm going to yell stop. If you see three layers, look at the clock and tell me how long that took. So, you know, ready, set, tick, 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 gets up to 12. She turns it over, all the stuff comes tumbling back through. She holds it up, stop, you know, can you see three layers? And, you know, they all nod, yes, okay, look at the clock. How long did that take? Hands went up all over the room. Millions of years, millions of years. And so it is really ingrained. Well, that little experiment, a lot of these other things, by the way, are in our children's book. And, of course, now we've got a lot of those things. One of the reasons it took me 3 years to change from evolution to creation was having to unlearn so many things I had been falsely taught. By the way, it's not usually the teacher's fault. They're not deliberately lying. They just are teaching what they were taught. You know, and they haven't really thought about it. And if you only hear one side, it sort of makes sense. And there are pre-programmed tests you can use, etc. So they were just passing this on. But what about Grand Canyon? Now, there's a big leap, you know, from a 4-foot plexiglass tube, you know, to a mile deep of layers spread out over thousands of square miles all across the North American continent. Am I trying to tell you all of that was laid down rapidly? And the answer is absolutely yes, without a doubt. And so here's a standard geologic cross-section through Grand Canyon. Down here in the bottom, in the inner gorge, is the, you know, little teeny worthless trickle you can swim across that can't move the boulders out of the side canyons, a little trickle we call the Colorado River. And it's trapped in some creation rock and pre-flood rock. And why do I call them that? Well, that creation rock are the granites and the schists, the igneous and metamorphic crystalline rocks that it looks like God created on day 3, and he put little timers in there for us that Dr. Morris talked about the last time, the halos and the helium diffusion rate, just to make sure we knew he did it and he didn't take billions of years of fumbling around to do it. And so he planted all this evidence for us. And then draped along the side, now in tilted form, are some pre-flood rocks. Well, why do I call them pre-flood? Well, two reasons. One, they hardly have any fossils in them at all. I mean, some things, coralline algae or you know, they were fossilized when they were alive, in a sense. They're just rocky, so they find fossils like that. But they don't form layers. This diagram, I got to redo this diagram. Oops. This doesn't show, you know, the Hakatai shale, soft crumbly shale. There'll be a little clump of it here, and then nothing. And then way down here, another little clump of it, nothing. And then way down here, another little clump. Same thing with this really hard quartzite. A little here, a little there, a little here. You know, it really looks more like a deposit laid down slowly and gradually. You know, between the fall and the flood, there were at least 1,656 years, and there would be rivers flowing downhill, and in some places they'd dump a little sand, some a little clay, some a little gravel, and so on. This would be going on. And so you'd have slow, gradual deposition of these things, and just a little here, a little there, hardly any fossils. If there was no Noah's flood, that'd be the way the whole earth would look. Grand Canyon would look like a swirl cake. There wouldn't be any big flat layers stretching across the continents. And so these seem to be pre-flood layers, but notice they're tilted. What happened? In fact, what's the first source of water mentioned in the Bible for the flood? Yeah, fountains of the great deep. Most people have heard of the 40 days and nights of rain, but the first thing mentioned was what? The fountains of the great deep burst forth. Now, that's a Hebrew phrase, and we can't be dogmatic about what it means, but boy, oh boy, does it make sense. In terms of what we know now, what made Mount St. Helens blow up? Not everybody knows this, but about two-thirds of what comes out of the average volcano, including Mount St. Helens, is water vapor. It doesn't do any harm, so it doesn't make the news, but that's where the power comes from. Superheated, pressurized water. All you have to do is open a little crack in it, and wham! The water flashes the steam, blows the tops off mountains, blows islands away, blows civilizations away. Awesome power. That little Mount St. Helens eruption was equivalent to the energy release of 20,000 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs. Awesome power in just a little volcano. And yet if you look down the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, that mid-Atlantic ridge are scores of volcanoes, all bigger than Mount St. Helens, that seem to go off simultaneously, producing banded lava flows and so on. Now there's an awesome power. Make the Third World War, the nuclear holocaust, look like nothing by energy comparison with that kind of eruption. And so it looks like one of the places where the fountains of the great deep burst forth is what we now call northern Arizona. So it pushed through the creation rocks, tilted the pre-flood rocks up on edge like that, and then the flood came. And the flood came with such great force and such great speed that it sheared off the pre-flood rocks in virtually a straight line. The great unconformity. It's an angular unconformity. And some of these rocks, as I mentioned, are real soft and crumbly. Some are really hard. If they had been slowly tilted up, gradually eroded over millions of years by rivers and raindrops, you'd have great big knife-like blobs of hard rock sticking up, and the soft stuff would have disappeared millions of years ago. It wouldn't be there at all. But it happened so fast, with such great force, that the hard and soft rocks were sheared off in nearly a straight line. The only exception is this Shinuma was so hard, it offered some resistance to the flood current that deposited what we now call a Tapete sandstone. It offered some resistance, but the flood current was so strong that it broke off huge chunks of this super hard rock, didn't roll them along the bottom, picked them up and carried them for miles, and then dumped them into the bottom. Well, here I am as Dr. Austin's water boy and size marker. There's about 6 feet from the bottom of my chute to the top of my pack. My arm is in the shadow of a boulder. This is not a great picture, but here's the bottom of that boulder, and the boulder's up here above my head. Dr. Austin was trying to get far enough away to get the whole boulder in the picture and couldn't do it with that lens in that position. In fact, those boulders would fill up about half of this church, the auditorium here. Those are the boulders picked up and moved by the first flood currents. By contrast, the present Colorado River can't even move boulders this big from in front of the side canyons. Something much more awesome than the Colorado River was involved. And then once the flood got started, just forgot all about evolution. And there are lots of beautiful views in the canyon. Here's one that shows this great big cliff here, the red wall limestone. It doesn't look great big here, but that's averages 400 to 600 feet thick, and it's virtually vertical. It's one of the big barriers to hiking in the canyon. You know, when some of Powell's team abandoned ship and said, we've had enough of shipwreck, we're hiking out of here, they never found them again. There's no way. You know, I mean, there's so few trails over that red wall, you'd never make it. And below that big red wall limestone is a little cliff. I took a chance. I had a double shot of that stuff out there. Makes it awful hard to hold this steady. But at any rate, okay, this little cliff here, okay, is that Muav limestone. Yeah, big deal. Red wall limestone, Muav limestone. What's the point? Between those two limestone layers, there's 150 million years of mythical evolutionary time missing without a trace. It's just gone. It's not there. Well, now, for an evolutionist, that's a colossal problem. You can't go ripping 150 million years out of the evolutionary story. That would break the evolutionary chain, make evolution impossible. So they went looking for evidence of erosion, enough erosion to erase 150 million years of rock, and they were honest enough to admit they did not find it. And they coined a word to deal with it. And that word is paraconformity. Conformity is where one rock layer is directly on top of the other rock layer. There's no break in time. Angular unconformity, you know, sheared edges of tilted rocks. A disconformity, if you have erosion, and we've studied these in geology class, sometimes you'll see a rock here and a rock below it, and you'll see channels up and down, wavy line, gravel deposits. You can see where the river flowed through it. It's all channeled and eroded. But they didn't find that there. There's no physical evidence of any erosion at all. There's no physical evidence that time existed at all. It just looks like Muav limestone, conformably red wall limestone right on top. There was no 150 million years. It's a myth if you just look at the evidence. And in one step, you can go right across 150 million years of missing evolutionary time. By the way, I don't like to call these things geologic ages or geologic time. It doesn't have anything to do with geology. And so I usually call them evolutionary ages and evolutionary time. It's just a story. Has nothing to do with the geological evidence. In fact, it's contradicted by the geological evidence. Well, I had first heard of these, and don't misquote me now, be sure you hear the whole story. In Dr. Henry Morris's book, you know, with John Whitcomb, The Genesis Flood, they talked about paraconformities. And I thought at the time, you know, this was when I was still struggling with this, that's crazy. You know, evolutionists would never, you know, be that dishonest and just make up a word like that. And so I just wrote it off. Well, years later, I'm in the stratigraphy class, and the prof, an evolutionist, is talking about conformities, unconformities, angular unconformities, disconformities, and then he said, and then there are paraconformities. What? That's a real word? And I thought that he would say, well, there's some creationists, you know, that pretend there's missing time. No, that's stupid, and they explain it. And he said, boy, he says, These things are a real mystery. He said, how can land just lie there for millions of years, neither depositing nor eroding, and then pick up like nothing happened at all? And he wrote the name Paraconformity on the board. We even had a field trip to study a small one in a southern Indiana quarry, just 25 million years missing. And it was on the test. And so on the test, he had a question. You know, what is a paraconformity? Give an example. Tell why they're important. And so, you know, I did that. But then I thought I'd take a chance. Up to this point, I'd been a straight-A student. I realized that was now on the line. But, you know, I said, well, let me just try this. And so I said, well, you know, the corals in this one layer, this was a small paraconformity in Indiana, they had to die out somewhere. Maybe they died out in southern Indiana. And of course, the next layer of corals had to start somewhere. Maybe they started in southern Indiana. So you went directly, you know, I split the 25 million years in half from one layer to the next coral layer just because the environment changed, different temperature, different saltiness. So that's why you don't see any evidence of erosion. And I sit back to wait for the results. Okay, so I get the test back and I open, oh, there's an A on the test. I turn back to the essay, big check mark. But that's all. So like I said, I went on every one of these prof student, you know, field trips and all that. So I went, what did you think about what I said about paraconformity, how maybe it's just a change in environment instead of a lot of time missing? And he said, well, yeah, he says, you know, I gave you an A. He said, I realized that would work, but I'm not sure I'm willing to give up that much time. I was only asking for 12 and a half million years. Most evolutionists will give you 100 right off. Okay. And notice, by the way, so many people say, boy, if Christians could just believe in millions of years, they wouldn't have any problem with science. No. Christians believe in millions of years, you won't have any problems with evolution. You'll have lots and lots and lots of problems with science. You won't have a clue how those rock layers got tilted up and sheared off equally. You won't have a clue how those boulders got picked up and moved for miles like that. You won't have a clue how you can skip this much supposed time with no evidence of erosion. What do evolutionists say about those three prominent features of Grand Canyon? Nothing. I've had students, I wanted them to do research, see what the evolution said so we could see what arguments we needed to look at. They've never even published anything on it. They don't even try to explain it. They just what? Are willingly ignorant of the facts that don't fit their particular view. It's in all the textbooks, but I've never found a single professional article on paraconformities. They know they exist, they just don't want to deal with it. And of course, the flood continued, you know, stacking up layer upon layer. Now here, I guess I thought Dr. Morris was going to talk about this. Here's Steve Austin. This is a new discovery. This is a pretty recent. And of course, Austin did that fabulous work on Mount St. Helens and coal, and now the Lord's given him another treat. You know, I come up with theories. I think it's about time the Lord took one of my theories seriously. But at any rate, this is just a 6-foot bed at the base of the Red Wall Limestone. See, it's a little different in color and texture from the others. And Austin noticed this. In fact, anybody noticed it. There was a canyon along the Colorado River called Nautiloid Canyon. And a nautilus is a shellfish. In this outer chamber here, there's a squid, you know, with the tentacles and the big eyes and the big brain out here. And then there are chambers, you know, marked off like this. And ice cream cone-shaped shell, a modern one's coiled, this one's straight. And as it grows, you know, it gets bigger and bigger like an ice cream cone. Well, anybody could go and look there, and the standard geology book said there are only a few nautiloids in Arizona, and they're in Nautiloid Canyon, in Grand Canyon. Well, Austin, you know, and he prayed about this and so on, and God can be, maybe that's why. Okay. But at any rate, yeah, give me some big research project. Well, he noticed, and this was kind of tricky because the rocks are all uneven and so on, so it wasn't really obvious, but he finally noticed that, hey, these things are lined up. And so if you have a lot of objects like this, if they just died one at a time, slowly and gradually over millions of years, you know, one would die and another one would die and the shell would fall down, they'd land at all kinds of random angles. But if they were killed at the same time by a flowing deposit, then they'd all be lined up in the direction of flow. And there's a geological test that you can do to measure that, and he did. And so he found out, wow, this is a flow deposit. Not just random slow accumulation. This is a flow deposit. And then he started looking for more nautiloids. Oh, the flow deposit, by the way, it looks like a massive one-time mass kill event. And sorry about that, but remember, this is a fallen world. This is a whole assemblage of young, old, middle-aged nautiloids minding their own business. And then a hydrothermal vent, probably one of these hot outgassings, you know, lava, stimulates, you know, a huge flow like that flow that severed the transatlantic cables in the Atlantic Ocean in 1929, flowing underwater at 60 miles an hour, laying down 100,000 square miles of sediment very quickly. So here's a fissure flow that buries these things. And how many of them did it bury? Well, now he's found all these little red dots indicating nautiloids here, all the way out to Las Vegas. Over, I guess that's about 300 miles worth of nautiloids. And calculated there'd be 4 billion of these things killed in a one-time event that left just a 6-foot layer, you know, all that distance from one end of the Grand Canyon to out past Vegas and so on. And even secular geologists have given Dr. Austin credit for awesome research. And they've actually treated this with respect, and they've realized it's revolutionized the geology of Arizona. This is pretty phenomenal. But then, of course, they just keep stacking up layers, and so stacking up layers all the way up to the top and so. But notice at this point, we've got lots of layers, but no canyon. And so remember, by the end of the flood, or actually by the middle of the flood, these layers here and all the fossils, there wasn't any Grand Canyon. There was just the grand sediment. And so there was sediment at the bottom of the ocean. And so at the end of the flood, it looks like God did what he did on creation day 3. On day 3, it says God gathered the waters together in one place and caused the dry land to appear. I just realized I didn't say anything about plate tectonics, did I? Must be in another talk, but that's a question. But at any rate, you know, gathered the waters together and then caused the dry land to appear. I have an evolutionist friend that says, that's your best evidence for the existence of God. He said, you know, if the world had spun down from a gas cloud like Big Bang Theory teaches, there'd be a layer of basalt, there'd be a layer of granite, there'd be 2 miles of water over the whole thing, there wouldn't be any land. He said, it looks like somebody with big hands, okay, that was his way, as close as he could come to saying God, took the granite, shoved it up in a pile. But everywhere he shoved the granite up in a pile, okay, he thinned out the basalt. Otherwise, if you had all the land piled on one side and the water on the other, the earth would wobble and crack as it rotated. But a lot of 3.0 density granite on top of little 3.3 basalt equals a lot of 1.0 water over a lot of 3.3 basalt. So the earth is roughly in balance. So God brought that ocean sediment. In Psalm 104, the mountains rose, the valley sank, the mountains rose above. Boy, did they rise above the water, 9,000 feet to the north rim. And so they were lifted way above the water. You start off with the grand sediment. Well, now you've got the grand dam. You've got a big pile of rock 9,000 feet above sea level acting as a natural earthen dam, trapping some of the leftover flood water draining out of the Colorado Basin. And as it begins to rain and all that kind of stuff, you know, the Colorado River starts to run out of the rising Colorado Rockies. Did the Colorado River cut the canyon? No way. By the time it gets to northern Arizona, it's about 4,000 feet above sea level. The rim of the canyon layers, the Grand Dam, is 9,000 feet above sea level. The Colorado would have to hack its way half a mile or a mile uphill to get started. Now what? It just pooled behind this natural Grand Dam, made 3 lakes that we can map geologically, each about the size of Lake Michigan. And now you've got huge lakes in southern Utah, western Colorado, northern Arizona, trapped behind these uplifted flood sediments, no canyon yet. But then the dam breaks. And when water spills over a steep slope like that, when it gets to about 20 miles an hour, it cavitates. It forms bubbles that, when they hit a surface, act like little hand grenades and begin to chisel into the rock like that, cutting the Grand Canyon very rapidly indeed. Here's a flood tube, a spillway around the Glen Canyon man-made dam. One year, a lot of spring runoff, a lot of snow melt, stuff like that. It looked like the water was going to flow over the top of the Glen Canyon Dam. So, you know, they start opening these spillway tubes, let more water out. Still the water was coming up. They opened the tube, let more water out. Still the water was rising. They opened the flood tube some more. All of a sudden, wham, wham, wham. Just like a machine gun going off. And the whole dam began to vibrate. And the water turned blood red. They shut down the flood tubes real quickly. In just 30 seconds, that cavitating, hand grenade bubble forming, fast flowing water shredded the steel reinforced concrete tubes and ate into the red rock. All they could do was pray the dam wouldn't overtop, and it didn't. But there was nothing they could do about it at that point. And so it really looks like that canyon formed rapidly at the end of the flood. What? The little Colorado River imprisoned in this great big huge canyon. June 1 to 6, 1982, Mount St. Helens goes off again and sure enough confirms another one of Dr. Austin's theory. And so that second eruption breached a dam on the North Fork of the Toutle River, sent a flow rushing through there, cut a 1 to 40 scale model of Grand Canyon in just 5 days. I had a chance to fly over it one time. Airline pilot took us right up the face of Mount St. Helens, right over the lip of the crater, right around the lava dome, which was glowing red. And I thought, boy, you know, if it erupts now, I could get a really good picture. Okay, and then out it was zigzag, you know, amphitheater head, side canyons. These layers that we once thought, you know, was a year for every little layer, you know, instead of being, hundreds of years, it's just a matter of seconds. Here's a person for scale next to Big Cliff, not millions of years, but just one afternoon. In that whole canyon with that little teeny stream trapped in the bottom. Yeah, you can imagine the trees are growing back and evolutionists will come in there and say, wonder how many million years it took that little stream to form that big canyon. No, the canyon came first, the river came second. Well, sometimes this, I'll have to skip over here. Sometimes I want, this is a great book on the canyon. This would be the book on the canyon with a lot of this information, all of this information, I guess. Sometimes I think, you know, there's a researcher who's been digging around in the canyon for years and trying to figure out what's going on. And so finally, you know, he decides to take a break and he hikes up to the rim of the canyon. There's a bench, you know, on the rim. And so he walks over to sit down and sure enough, there's a Gideon Bible. So he picks up the Bible and starts to read. Says, now I know what I've been seeing here at Grand Canyon. Now I know why, every time I find a fossil, it's something so marvelously well designed. Why the plants and animals at the bottom are just as complex as the ones living today. Life is not a product of time, chance, struggle, and death, evolution. Life is a gift of God, results of plan, purpose, and special acts of creation. Now I know why this canyon is full of dead things. Billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid out over thousands of square miles. Man's sin corrupted God's perfect world, brought death, brought disease, brought disaster, brought decline. Now I know how those rocks got tilted up and how they got sheared off, how those boulders got moved, how that paraconformity formed, how that canyon got formed. It wasn't a lot of time, it was what? A lot of water, not a lot of time. But praise God, here I am looking at it. How could anything have survived the awesome forces that produced the layers in the canyon that we're looking at? Only God could have provided a way of escape, an ark of safety to repopulate the world. And praise God, He's coming again to save us from the judgment by fire yet. And a new heavens and a new earth. Those millions of years aren't in the past doing me no good. Those millions of years are in the future in perfect fellowship with our risen Lord.